Hello and welcome to this episode of Epochs, where I shall be continuing my narrative of the decline and fall of the Roman Republic, and specifically the bit where Julius Caesar is in Gaul, which I'm doing in lots and lots of detail, which people seem to like, and I enjoy doing it. As you'll notice, for technical and scheduling reasons, we're not in the second studio, we're in the first studio, but we've got this old background that we put together and then never used at one point. Serves us very well today, doesn't it? Okay, so straight into the narrative. If you remember last time, picked up, or left off rather, where Julius Caesar was just about to invade Britain for the second time in the year 54 BC. So Caesar picks up his own story by saying this, quote, "Caesar then set sail, leaving Labienus on the continent with 3 legions and 2,000 cavalry, with orders to guard the ports, provide for a supply of corn, watch events in Gaul, and act as circumstances from time to time might require. Caesar took with him 5 legions and the remaining 2,000 cavalry." 5 legions and 2,000 cavalry, that's quite a lot. He wasn't taking it easy this time. "And putting out about sunset, was at first carried on his way by a light southwesterly breeze. But about midnight the wind dropped, with the result that he was driven far out of his course by the tidal current, and at daybreak saw Britain left behind on the port side. When the set of the current changed, he went with it, and rowed hard to make the part of the island where he had found the best landing places the year before. The soldiers worked splendidly, and by continuous rowing enabled the heavily laden transports to keep up with the warships. When the whole fleet reached Britain about midday, no enemy was to be seen. Caesar discovered afterwards from prisoners that, although large numbers had assembled at the spot, they were frightened by the sight of so many ships, and had quitted the shore to conceal themselves on higher ground. Including those retained from the previous year and the privately owned vessels built by individuals for their own use, over 800 ships were visible simultaneously." End quote. So that really is a vast armada. People have always argued to what extent Caesar, what Caesar really meant to achieve with this second invasion. The first one was pretty clearly a reconnaissance in force, no more than that. But this second one, people argue, did he mean, do you think he did want to try and actually subdue the whole island, or at least the majority of it, or not at this point? You know, the amount of men and material and effort he's putting into it, I would be inclined to believe that he is trying to conquer the whole of Britannia. Maybe not the whole of it. I mean, they didn't even know the extent, how far north it stretched, but to give it a bloody good crack, certainly. The narrative goes on. "Caesar disembarked his army and chose a suitable spot for a camp. On learning from prisoners where the enemy were posted, he left 10 cohorts and 300 cavalry on the coast to guard the fleet and marched against the Britons shortly after midnight. Feeling little anxiety about the ships because he was leaving them anchored on an open shore and soft sand. The fleet and its guard were put under the command of Quintus Atreus." So now we get to the crux of it. The fighting starts. Caesar jumps straight in. I mean, in this relatively small section of the whole story, his second invasion of Britain, it's quite quick. Caesar doesn't spend a great deal of time and energy describing things in lots and lots of detail, so it's almost a montage, but he just jumps straight into the action. There's no real preamble and not much politicking going on. He tells us this, quote, "A night march of about 12 miles brought Caesar in sight of the enemy, who advanced to a river with their cavalry and chariots, and tried to bar his way by attacking from a position on higher ground. Repulsed by his cavalry, they hid in the woods, where they occupied a well-fortified post of great natural strength, previously prepared, no doubt, for some war among themselves, since all the entrances were blocked by felled trees laid close together. Scattered parties made skirmishing attacks out of the woods, trying to prevent the Romans from penetrating the defences. But the soldiers of the 7th Legion, locking their shields together over their heads and piling up the earth against the fortifications, captured the place and drove them out of the woods at the cost of only a few men wounded. Caesar forbade them to pursue far, however, because he did not know the ground and because he wanted to devote the few remaining hours of the day to the fortification of his camp. The next morning he sent out a force of infantry and cavalry in 3 columns to pursue the fleeing enemy. They had advanced some way and were in sight of the nearest fugitives when dispatch riders brought up news from Atreus of a great storm in the night, by which nearly all the ships had been damaged or cast ashore. The anchors and cables had not held, and the sailors and their captains could not cope with such a violent gale, so that many vessels were disabled by running foul of one another." Another naval catastrophe for Caesar in the Channel. "Caesar at once ordered the legions and cavalry to be halted and recalled. He himself went back to the beach, where with his own eyes he saw pretty much what the messengers and the dispatch had described. About 40 ships were a total loss, The rest looked as if they could be repaired at the cost of much trouble. Accordingly, he called out all the skilled workmen from the legions, sent to the continent for more, and wrote to tell Labienus to build as many ships as possible with the troops under his command. Further, although it was a task involving enormous labour, he decided that it would be best to have all the ships beached and enclosed together with the camp by one fortification. This work, although it was continued day and night, took some 10 days to complete. As soon as the ships were hauled up and the camp strongly fortified, Caesar left the same units as before to guard them and returned to the place from which he had come. On arriving there, he found that the larger British forces had now been assembled from all sides by Cassivelaunus, to whom the chief command and direction of the campaign had been entrusted by common consent. Cassivelaunus's territory is separated from the maritime tribes by a river called the Thames and lies about 75 miles from the sea. Previously, he had been continually at war with the other tribes, but the arrival of our army frightened them into appointing him their supreme commander. So there's nothing like a deadly common enemy to draw people together. Everyone recognised Caesar as the existential threat, of course. Now, at this point in the narrative, Caesar breaks off a bit from the action. He was just about to have a battle with Cassivelaunus. But now he sort of breaks off his narrative of just briefly to just talk about Britain in general terms. So he says this, and these lions are gold dust, you know, just like the Germans and the Gauls. There hasn't been a great deal of any real literary evidence before this, so it's some of the first details we get about Britons, in a literary sense anyway. Caesar said this, quote, "The interior of Britain is inhabited by people who claim, on the strength of an oral tradition, to be aboriginal. The coast, by Belgic immigrants who came to plunder and make war, nearly all of them retaining the names of the tribes from which they originated and later settled down to till the soil. The population is exceedingly large, the ground thickly studded with homesteads, closely resembling those of the Gauls, and the cattle very numerous. For money, they use either bronze or gold coins, or iron ingots of fixed weights. Tin is found inland, and small quantities of iron near the coast. The copper that they use is imported. There is timber of every kind, as in Gaul, except beech and fir. Hares, fowl, and geese they think is unlawful to eat, but rear them for pleasure and amusement. The climate is more temperate than in Gaul, the cold being less severe," end quote. Now, if anyone remembers, I have read that passage before when I did talk to Josh in the old studio quite a while ago, a couple of years ago now, about Roman Britain. But it is a very, very famous paragraph. And if you hadn't noticed, there are a few odd things in there, that they keep hares and fowl and geese just for fun. They think it's unlawful to eat those things. Very odd, isn't it? And that Caesar said, the cold is less severe in Britain than in France. Again, practically everyone would disagree with that. But there you go, maybe it was just a very, very nice summer, the summer of 54 BC. Gave him the impression that it's warmer in Britain, even though it just simply isn't. Okay, the story goes on here. He said this. The island is triangular, with one side facing Gaul. One corner of this side, on the coast of Kent, is the landing place for nearly all the ships from Gaul, and points east. The lower corner points south. The length of this side is about 475 miles. Another side faces west towards Spain. In this direction is Ireland, which is supposed to be half the size of Britain, and lies at the same distance from it as Gaul. Midway across is the Isle of Man, and it is believed that there are also a number of smaller islands, in which, according to some writers, there is a month of perpetual darkness at the winter solstice. Our inquiries on this subject were always fruitless, but we found by accurate measurements, with a water clock, that the nights are shorter than on the continent. This side of Britain, according to the natives' estimate, is 665 miles long. The third side faces north. No land lies opposite it, but its eastern corner points roughly in the direction of Germany. Its length is estimated at 760 miles. Thus, the whole island is 1,900 miles in circumference. By far the most civilised inhabitants are those living in Kent, a purely maritime district, whose way of life differs little from that of the Gauls. Most of the tribes in the interior do not grow corn, but live on milk and meat, and wear skins. All the Britons dye their bodies with woad, which produces a blue colour, and shave the whole of their bodies, except the head and the upper lip. Wives are shared between groups of 10 or 12 men, especially between brothers, and between fathers and sons, but the offspring of these unions are counted as the children of the men with whom a particular woman cohabited first. Again, a few odd details there. Interesting details. Not a monogamous culture. The British cavalry and charioteers had a fierce encounter with our cavalry on the march. And that's all Caesar really says about it. The next thing he cuts back to just talking about fighting and action. But that little snapshot, two or three paragraphs, sort of a vitally important bit of history. And who knows to what degree Caesar had things accurate. Had the reports he'd been given been accurate? Had the things he'd seen with his own eyes, were they anomalies or were they commonplace? Who really knows? He continues back on with the action then. He says this. The British cavalry and charioteers had a fierce encounter with our cavalry on the march. But our men had the best of it everywhere and drove them into the woods and hills, killing a good many, but also incurring some casualties themselves by a too eager pursuit. The enemy waited for a time and then, while our soldiers were off their guard and busy fortifying the camp, suddenly dashed out of the woods, swooped upon the outpost on duty in front of the camp, and started a violent battle. Caesar sent two cohorts, the first of their respective legions, to the rescue, and these took up a position close together. But the men were unnerved by the unfamiliar tactics, and the enemy very daringly broke through between them and got away unhurt. That day, Quintus Liberius Durus, a military tribune, was killed. The attack was eventually repulsed by throwing in some more cohorts. You get the impression Caesar's fairly blasé about some of this stuff sometimes, knowing that if it's any sort of one-on-one combat or any sort of encounter where the numbers will have any sort of parity, Caesar's not worried. He's completely confident that his men will overcome any sort of native resistance with ease if it's anywhere near close in numbers. Throughout this particular combat, which was fought in front of the camp in full view of everyone, it was seen that our troops were too heavily weighted by their armour to deal with such an enemy. They could not pursue them when they retreated, and dared not yet separate from their standards. The cavalry, too, found it very dangerous work fighting the charioteers, for the Britons would generally give ground on purpose, and after drawing them some distance from the legions, would jump down from their chariots and fight on foot, with the odds in their favour. In engaging their cavalry, our men were not much better off. Their tactics were such that the danger was exactly the same for both pursuers and pursued. A further difficulty was that they never fought in very close order, but in very open formation, and had reserves posted here and there. In this way, the various groups covered one another's retreat, and fresh troops replaced those who were tired. So the different tactics of the charioteers causing a bit of a headache for Caesar, but if we know Caesar by now, he'll be able to think up some sort of countermeasures. He continues his narrative saying this, quote, "Next day the enemy took up a position on the hills at a distance from the camp. They showed themselves now only in small parties and harassed our cavalry with less vigour than the day before. But at midday, when Caesar had sent three legions and all the cavalry on a foraging expedition under his general Gaius Trebonius, they suddenly swooped down on them from all sides, pressing their attack right up to the standards of the legions. The legionaries drove them off by a strong counter-attack and continued to pursue until the cavalry, emboldened by the support of the legions which they saw close behind them, made a charge that sent the natives flying headlong. A great many were killed, and the rest were given no chance of rallying or making a stand or jumping from their chariots. This rout caused the immediate dispersal of the forces that had assembled from various tribes to Cassiovellinus's aid, and the Britons never again joined battle with their whole strength." So it seems like Caesar made fairly short work of them, to be perfectly honest. I mean, there's more to go yet. The story isn't over, but in that first sort of sharp engagement, sort of testing the waters, testing out each other's abilities and skills and numbers and things, Caesar and the Romans were just completely unfazed, as usual. And the native Britons just seemed to have shrunk from the challenge. The account goes on, quote, "On learning the enemy's plan of campaign, Caesar led his army to the Thames in order to enter Cassiovellinus's territory. The river is fordable at one point only, and even there with difficulty. At this place, he found large enemy forces drawn up on the opposite bank. The bank was also fenced by sharp stakes fixed along the edge, and he was told by prisoners and deserters that similar ones were concealed in the riverbed. He sent the cavalry across first, and then at once ordered the infantry to follow. But the infantry went with such speed and impetuosity, although they had only their heads above the water, that they attacked at the same moment as the cavalry. The enemy was overpowered and fled from the riverbank. Cassiovellinus had now given up all hope of fighting a pitched battle, disbanding the greater part of his troops, he retained only some 4,000 charioteers with whom he watched our line of march. He would retire a short way from the route and hide in dense thickets, driving the inhabitants and cattle from the open country into the woods wherever he knew we intended to pass. If ever our cavalry incautiously ventured too far away in plundering and devastating the country, he would send all his charioteers out of the woods by well-known lanes and pathways and deliver very formidable attacks, hoping by this means to make them afraid to go far afield. Caesar was thus compelled to keep the cavalry in touch with the column of infantry and to let the enemy off with such devastation and burning as could be done under the protection of the legionaries, tired as they often were with marching. End quote. So just to reiterate, you know, a lot of this is about murder and rapine and rape and completely wanton destruction. And there just would have been a swathe of misery and killing in the Romans' path, in the Romans' wake. Caesar continues, during this march, envoys arrived from the Trinovantes, about the strongest tribe in southeastern Britain. Mandubracius, a young man of his tribe, had gone over to the continent to put himself under Caesar's protection, having fled for his life when his father, the king of the Trinovantes, was killed by Cassiovellinus. The envoys promised to surrender and obey Caesar's commands and asked him to protect Mandubracius from Cassiovellinus and send him home to rule his people as king. Caesar demanded 40 hostages for his troops and then allowed Mandubracius to go. The Trinovantes promptly sent the required number of hostages and the grain. When they saw that the Trinovantes had been protected against Cassiovellinus and spared any injury on the part of the Roman troops, several other tribes, the Senimangi, Segontiaci, Ancolites, Bibrochi and Cassi, sent embassies and surrendered. From them, Caesar learnt that he was not far from Cassiovellinus' stronghold, which was protected by forests and marshes, and had been filled with a large number of men and cattle. The Britons applied the term strongholds to densely wooded spots fortified with a rampart and trench, to which they retire in order to escape the attacks of invaders. He marched to the place with his legions, and found that it was of great natural strength, and excellently fortified. Nevertheless, he proceeded to assault it on two sides. After a short time, the enemy proved unable to resist the violent attack of the legions and rushed out of the fortress on another side. A quantity of cattle was found there, and many of the fugitives were captured or killed. So again, from us who wish we had so much more detail, Caesar feels a bit flippant there. They had these great strongholds, but we just overawed them easily. Anyway, next thing. We really do wish we had more detail about all of this, but still, there we are. That's the nature of ancient history. While these operations were proceeding in this territory, Cassiovellinus sent envoys to Kent ordering the four kings of that region, Cingetorix, Carvilius, Taximangulus, and Segovax, to collect all their troops and make a surprise attack on the naval camp. When these forces appeared, the Romans made a sortie, in which without suffering any loss, they killed a great many of them and captured Lugatocrix, a leader of noble birth. On receiving news of this action, Cassiovellinus, alarmed by so many reverses, by devastation of his country, and above all by the defection of his allies, sent envoys to Caesar to obtain terms of surrender, employing Commius as an intermediary. Caesar had decided to return to the continent for the winter, for fear any sudden rising should break out in Gaul. The summer too was nearly over, and he knew that the Britons could easily hold out for the short time that remained. Accordingly, he granted Cassiovellinus's request for terms, demanding hostages, fixing an annual tribute to be paid by the Britons to the Roman government, and strictly forbading Cassiovellinus to molest Mandubracius or the Trinovantes. As soon as the hostages were delivered, he led the army back to the coast, where he found the ships repaired. He had them launched, and as he had a large number of prisoners, and some of the ships had been destroyed by the storm, decided to make the return voyage in two trips. It happened that all of these large fleets, which made so many voyages in this and the preceding war, not a single ship with troops on board was lost, while very few of the vessels coming over empty from the continent, i.e. those which had returned to Gaul after landing troops in Britain, and 60 that Labienus had built after the start of the expedition, reached their destination, nearly all the rest being forced back to land. After waiting a long time for them in vain, Caesar was afraid of being prevented from sailing by the approaching season of the equinox, and so had to pack the men more tightly than usual on the ships he had. The sea becoming very calm, he set sail late in the evening and brought all the fleet safely to land at dawn. End quote. So that is the entirety of Caesar's account of his second incursion into Britain. And at the considerable risk of sounding like a broken record, we wish we had more on that. But that's all we've got. And he just moves on. And it's a shame. There is, of course, all sorts of archaeology backing up this stuff. Some people say they don't believe anything, or hardly anything, Caesar wrote in this account. It's sort of all made up. Well, it's not. There may be exaggerations here or there. There may be quite a lot of exaggeration, but things being made up entirely out of whole cloth. No, the archaeology shows the Romans were there at that time.
If you would like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.